July 27, 2009, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you. says it all at once. Like time sublimely silences the wise. I know that if I try, I'm gonna take a fall at once and splatter there between my lies. The only time I can write a song is really, really real. The best a man can say is how it's play on him does feel. And though he only knows as much as time to him among our chances, there's a chance we can choose. And if uncertainty will give us that permission, then it's impossible to lose. The only time you can write a song that's really, really real. The best a man can say is how it's play on him just feel. And though he only knows as much as time to him reveals.
Flop for Pedro Show. I'm here in, not Pedro though, I'm in New York City. And,
which is Nitro.
Nitro?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's the Lower East Side part of New York City.
Yeah.
And it's Richard Hell's pad here. And he's my guest on the show. Oh, I should say, I started off with John Coltrane doing Welcome. Welcome, Richard. The Wild from Pedro Show.
And I wish I'd have heard it.
And then
when do I get to hear it?
As soon as we get done, it'll go right up. You can hear it many, many times. And then we heard Time, speaking of times,
right.
By
a demo version that's on Spurge, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because when I got it, it was on a 7-inch. And one side had
Neon Boys.
And one had Don't Die and Time.
Time, right, yeah.
Now, were those demos?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Same exact version that's on Spurt.
Yeah.
But maybe a little less crack.
I wonder how much different they sound. I don't know, because, you know, definitely it went through a few stages of mastering.
Right. I remember the level was pretty low because you had two songs on each side. So it was kind of quieter. On the record player, I'd have to turn it up a little bit. But they were trippy sounding compared to the Blank Generation. And, of course, it was the first time I ever heard Neon Boys. I had no idea.
It's the only time anybody ever heard Neon Boys, you know.
We
never played live, and that's the only thing.
Neon Boys never had a gig?
No.
Wow.
Yeah, in fact, we cut those tracks that are on that single you're talking about, which are also on Spurts.
Yeah, right.
The compilation CD from Rhino. We made those tapes because we had finally just thrown in the towel, thought we can't find a second guitar player, and we had Billy Ficca up in New York away from home, brought him here in order to form a band, and then we spent months looking for a guitar player and we couldn't find one, but we had rehearsed those songs and written those songs during that period, and so we thought, well, we got to have something to show for this effort before we send Billy home. And that's what we did. We went in and recorded like six songs.
Yeah, because
three
it's a
that
high heel
I wrote
shoe.
And sang. I mean, I wrote the lyrics and sang. He at that time I wasn't really writing music yet. Though I kind of came up with this song called High Heel Wheels, which
that's it, High Heel Wheels.
Because that's the same bass line as You Gotta Lose. I mean, it's based on the same. Tom did three and I did three, and Tom's never allowed his to be released. So.
What three were those?
I can't remember the names of them.
Because I have
one of them was called Hot Dog. One of them was called, I think one of them was called 1650. I'm not sure. Maybe Poor Circulation. I can't remember
but
for
that's
sure.
Because I got some gigs of you guys playing together as television. And I think
and then a couple of songs survived,
Poor Circulation. Well, your first bass lick is you got to lose, and that you put it on the high heel wheels.
Right.
How'd you get into the bass?
Well,
from a bass player.
When we started a band,
yeah.
We wanted to be able to play right away.
Yeah.
And you can, Tom had been playing guitar for years. It would have taken me way much longer to become competent enough on guitar to perform than it would to learn some bass lines just by rote. So,
everyone says.
So that's basically the reason why, because it was possible to play it right away without okay. any really knowledge of how it's played, except that you learn your line,
yeah,
you
know, yeah,
and then
yeah.
you can gradually pick it up as you go along. But,
so. Did you know bass players?
I never even realized what a bass was supposed to do.
Yeah.
I didn't have any idea what purpose it served in a band. I mean, and, you know, that can be an advantage in a way because you're not trapped in any conventions, you know.
Right.
But on the other hand, I have come to really appreciate good bass playing. So I wish I'd had, you know, it makes me wish that I at least had the option of playing well
when, right.
back in those days, but I didn't because
you
didn't,
were in the
I
moment right.
I did not know what the function of the bass was, you know, except I knew that I mean obviously it supplies the bottom most. Okay, hang on one second. Are you going to stop it or
no?
Hey.
So, you know,
yeah,
that's kind of interesting.
Was that correct in your email that you...
You know what I think, what he kind of means is, I'm going to ask him when he comes back in here, but I think what he means is
yeah.
the urge to get the band going was stronger than having to realize what the bass was. So, you know, a band needed a bass, so he's going to do the bass. I mean, this is what I'm guessing. Now, my situation, my mother, not my mother, D. Boone's
okay,
mother.
If you guys don't object,
sorry about it. She said, you're going to be the bass player because I guess...
No, because I had thought that I wouldn't...
Yeah, you know, we saw it on record covers, too, a lot.
I don't know.
You know, all the bands had basses.
But
the Doors,
Would you have a suggestion?
But... I ended up on it. I was really glad I did. Like Richard, I kind of wished a little bit I would have known, what it was about. I didn't even realize kind of it was about low end. But I don't know. I'm just very interested in this now.
Keep talking
because
while I'm in the other room.
from this book. So what I was telling the people there is the urge to get the band together was stronger than the need to know what the bass was. So sure, I'll do it.
The theory was at the very beginning I could just be shown adequate simple bass lines that I could just learn by rote, and little by little as we learned more songs and I rehearsed, I would get the hang of you know, playing stuff that was more complex, and also of making up my own bass lines instead of relying on Verlaine to show me something simple that would
Tom,
you know,
showed you
suffice.
Oh,
you know?
Wow. Because it always seemed to me, my take on your bass lines was like this trippy kind of feeling it out.
Well, by the time you heard anything, I was writing them all.
Right, okay.
I'm just talking about...
It's such
a
personalized way.
6 months of Neon Boys in the television, and television, I would just be shown parts by Verlaine because I didn't know how to play.
Right. This urge to make the band, where did this come from? How did you meet Tom?
Oh, gee.
Born? Okay. But you wanted to make a band. You met this guy who can play guitar and you wanted to make a band with him.
I've heard that stuff so much, so often.
I haven't really heard it a lot.
You've asked
not from
me
the man.
Before.
Yeah, I have.
You just don't remember.
That's a big problem with me. But they might be curious.
When we first met, you were asking me all
this
stuff.
Of course. I had about 10 million things to ask.
See, so you can't turn this thing off? Once we start, yeah, we're just going?
I can turn it off.
Maybe we should have a little discussion.
Okay. Hold on. Then we'll play some music.
Thank you.
That wasn't you weren't recording?
Yeah, now we are.
Oh,
tell us what we played.
Yeah,
Richard.
This was that was Charlie Parker from 1948 on 52nd Street playing live when a guy just came to the gig. It was another musician with a tape recorder, obviously sitting near to Bird and the bass player, and you can hear the drums pretty well. But a couple of spots in there where you can kind of pick up Miles, because he's in the group too.
Very young.
Not only is he not play that much, but the guy who was taping wasn't interested in anything but Bird. So you don't hear much of the Miles, but yeah, God, it's just, it's so, it just carries you off to another plane, listening to that playing and to imagine that, that's all live, and he's making that up as he goes along, and there's nothing like that now that I know about, where you can go sit someplace and just be lifted out of yourself by this like magnificent, imaginative, musical thing going on. Anyway, so that was Bird from a CD called Bird on 52nd Street. Which is just a bootleg. It was brought out on eventually released. Before that, we heard the Five Royales doing a cut called Think from 1957. They wrote that tune, and then a couple of years later, James Brown recorded a version that is better known. But the Five Royales were interesting for being a kind of transition group between sort of gospel to doo-wop, but leading into what would be called soul music. Because you can hear the the attention they give to the guitar in their group, which was never done by that type of group at that time, and it sounds really great. And then before that was James Brown himself doing Can't Stand Myself When You Touch Me from 1967.
Part one.
Right. Okay, but then you were asking me why did I start a band? Was that what it was? Like, what made me go into it out of having no musical background, suddenly begin a rock and roll band? Well, I had some knowledge of music. When I was a kid, I played clarinet.
Oh.
For 2 or 3 years. I was really lazy about it, but I had a facility for it.
Yeah.
And it was a funny thing. When I was a kid, for whatever reason, you know, I guess different instruments can have different cycles of popularity for this instrument or that. And for whatever reason, when I was in junior high school, clarinets were the instrument of choice. And my school orchestra, the whole orchestra was maybe 40, 45 people or something like that, right? Big public school. Yeah. In like 8th or 9th grade, there were 22 clarinets.
So that's a band clarinet.
In a band of 45. And I was second chair, first section. In other words, I was the next to best player.
Right.
And I was next to the best of somebody who actually cared. And I I never did learn how to practice. I got was from rehearsing songs. I would never.
You mean with the band?
Practice, yeah.
No solo.
Yeah, I would never sit at home and.
What town was this?
Lexington, Kentucky. Yeah.
Because I was thinking of Bert. I mean, you got the recording here in New York City, but he's from Kansas City.
That's right.
And Miles.
There was a big
East St. Louis.
Scene
these guys
in Kansas
went.
City. He was Miles St. Louis.
Yeah, right. I think Lester Young, Kansas City. I think.
Was he Kansas City?
Yeah, there's a lot of cats came out of the Midwest, but they went to New York City.
Well, it's always like that. Yeah. I mean.
So you were.
I mean,
thinking.
There's only there's always the big center where everybody got to gather to make their mark and try to get somewhere. But then when I didn't begin that first band until I was 22. Wait, 23 even.
I was 22 when I did that.
Because I've been. I had come to New York, dropped out of high school, with the idea of making a name for myself as a poet. Then within a couple of years, my old best friend from school came to New York too. I was making my way writing, I had getting stuff published, publishing things myself with a little press I had bought. But it was starting to feel frustrating and futile because just nobody really cared. I mean, my generation just didn't read, and I wanted to have an impact. I wasn't snobbish about it at all. I mean, to me, the inclination to read and write is a kind of it's a specialization, it's like it's not something that I expect everybody to have an interest in, but I wasn't quite prepared for how obscure it was. Nobody but me cared about poetry of anybody I ever met. Just about.
But you knew New York City had some people doing that, or had a history of it.
Yeah, there was scenes, but they were like, they were so obscure. It was like nobody cared outside of the circle of people who actually did it themselves. The only other direction for writers to go was, if they were writing poetry, you know, was towards universities, you know, where they could get jobs teaching, and that was never a remote possibility for me. Just eliminated, because I always hated school. So my friend, who from high school, played guitar, and he wrote too, and we used to have fun writing stuff together, and we had a lot of interests in common. Intention was to become a professional musician, but he didn't have very much initiative. I mean, he practiced a lot. He loved to play, but in terms of becoming professional, I mean, the most he ever did was once or twice a year go play a open mic night someplace in a folk club. And I was getting so frustrated and restless in the poetry line that I started to. And then plus another factor was the New York Dolls happened, and they were so exciting. They were there, and they were artists. You know, they were so exciting. They were so natural. But they also had, you know, they knew what they were doing in terms of creating something that was a whole full-bodied realm, you know, from the way that they behaved to the way they dressed to the way their music sounded to what the lyrics said. And they weren't virtuosos, you know, they were coming out of just depending on attitude and self-confidence and the desire to have fun and make their mark and have their say as being sufficient to be a great band. And they demonstrated that that was possible, and how you could not only did not have to be conventionally very skilled in a conventional way, but that it really was, there was no limit to how creative you could be. I mean, in fact, it included so many realms, areas to be creative in, whether it was the graphics that, you know, carry a message, the clothes, the haircuts, the sound of the music, the lyrics. It was a whole universe of...
Yeah, you told me even how they put on their gigs, having a residency.
Right. That was that was something that I learned from them, too. Yeah, that when we first started, when we were ready to go out and play, I thought we should do what the Dolls did, which is find a place where we could play every week. Because that way, people who are interested in us didn't have to like try to figure out and follow us around, and but would be able to rely on knowing that they could go out for a good time on Saturday night here. And so that's how we turned up CBGBs. Anyway, so the I began to think, wow, maybe the solution to my, maybe the direction to go, like the get to release this stuff that I wanted to be putting out there was in a band. And so Tom had only been playing acoustic guitar. Then we started talking about making a band, and I would as I was saying before, bass was the natural way for me to go, because it was something I could learn to play adequately for the type of material we were doing, song by song immediately, and then have the idea that I, you know, would improve and get be able to you know get branch out the longer we play. But so that's how we started the band.
What
now,
about the third guy,
Mike? I do not want to go into step by step, like the following 3 or 4 years, everything.
But what about your drummer?
That have that you go read, you know, like Peace Kill Me or.
Oh, yeah, that has a lot. What about your drummer man, though? I thought that was interesting.
What?
Because you said Neon Boys never played a gig, but drummer had to go home. So that's why you ended up doing the recordings.
Because
I didn't know that. I thought Neon Boys did gigs.
But people don't even know who the Neon Boys are. But anyway, that was something that came out. I mean, my first band, for all intents and purposes, is Richard Hell and the Voidoids, you know, because that's the first band that I made a record with.
Right.
But I was in two groups before that for a year each. Television,
that short of time.
That I was one of the founders of.
Yeah.
Two groups, Television and the Heartbreakers. Television was like 74 to mid 75. Heartbreakers was like 75 to mid 76. And then I made the band that I have a record of. But you now you're asking about the Neon Boys, which is a really esoteric information. But yeah, there was one single that came out, you know, 5 years later in 1980 or something like that. I don't can't remember, of a group that was the very first time that I ever tried to play when we were first me and Verlaine were first. Working up material and trying to find a guitar player, second guitar player, and the drummer was Tom's friend from Delaware, where Tom lived, named Billy Ficca. And so we needed, in order to audition people, we wanted, and to work up material, we wanted to have Billy here. So we asked him to move up to New York to form this band, and then we couldn't find a second guitar player. And we finally gave up because there was the pressures of having, you know, pulled Billy out of his life to be come up here to make a band. And then there was no band being made because we couldn't find a guitar player. So we had to finally give up on that. That's when we made this recording of...
You didn't want to be a trio.
Like an 8-track. No, we needed two guitars. Yeah. Yeah, that was the whole conception, was two guitars.
And D. Boone did not want another guitar. We wanted to be a trio.
Right, well that,
but
that's,
Billy,
that's
very distinctive. Yeah, I know everybody's got a different trip. Very distinctive drummer. And being bass player, you know.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a little curious about drummers sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially ones that are...
Yeah, he plays a... He's very unusual drumming style.
So I was like wondering
so,
where he
so
came from.
So rackety and you know, like so all over the place. Like, it's, you know, he comes out of jazz, but there's no jazz drummers that play like that either.
No,
it's
no.
Like, but I mean, I guess you know, I mean, it's definitely.
Were you curious about how the bass and the drums talk together at that point?
No, I know nothing about that. I didn't know anything about playing bass. I never ever became a good bass player. I would come up with lines that I could use to teach to get the band to play the changes that I wanted and have an idea of the feel.
Yeah, I was a big fan of it, though.
Well,
sometimes
you
don't know what's happening, right? All I'm hearing is stuff come out of speaker. I have some image. You guys, maybe like the Dolls thing, you had a package. There was an image there, but there was also sounds that I wasn't hearing from Arena Rock, man.
Yeah.
There were some bass sounds. I just...
On that Blank Generation album, there isn't any record that sounds like that.
No.
I mean, and I don't think most people... really get it, like really respond to it. And even me, I go through cycles of you know, of finding it really exciting and then other times thinking it's just lame and incompetent.
Really? We thought it was a mind-blowing
some songs or other, you know.
I mean, we're coming from Pedro and whatever. Maybe our perspective was skewed. You know what was a real trip? Was the last three songs. You did a Creedence song.
Yeah, yeah.
We couldn't, because we were
waiting
for Creedence.
Yeah, right.
And then it goes into this weird...
But did you recognize that as a Creedence? Did you know that tune?
We knew Creedence. When I met Deep Blue, we only
knew
Creedence.
Because that was the Gollywogs, right? I mean,
yeah, but we only... It's on the first album.
Yeah, it is.
With a bass solo.
Yeah, right.
It's
right,
the only one
that
right.
says... But our version sure sounds different, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right. And we thought this was the idea of punk. It wasn't a sound. It was a state of the mind.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next song... was this trippy story and these chords. D Boom was like, yeah, look at these chords, because we're seeing gigs in Hollywood that are nothing like this. And then that bass line, and the it was on the single too, but it was a little different. Man, that is such a trippy bass line.
Pretty close
for another, well, it sounds different. It's more like toothpaste coming out of a toothpaste tube. It's bad. I mean, it just really was mind blow on us.
Yeah.
And maybe it's our fault, you know, and maybe you shouldn't blame yourself, but man, we just, it had phenomenal impact on us, you know, from copying songs in our house.
You know, I'm very, you know, I feel real good about that record. I don't have any, I'm not trying to say that the record's not good, but there are times when it sounds to me like transcendent, and then other times when it just sounds like, I wish I'd known better about this thing here, and that could have been done in a different way that would be an improvement, you know. I'm good with it.
Yeah, good, good. Because Justice said, like, you know what? You can do any. These guys made their own world. Don't be afraid.
You know, I know.
Much
that's
respect
the whole
to Chuck
thing.
Berry
right.
and whatever. But
right.
you know what? Go
I mean,
on.
That's yeah. what I loved about yeah. you guys. Is that. I mean, like I was saying the other night with that that tribute to the 25th anniversary of, is that, like, when I started a band, I had a dream of what a band could be, but it turned out I didn't really have the stamina. But the Minutemen had the stamina. Like, you went in there like I did, with knowing nothing except that you had something that you wanted to make heard, and you had no clue about what the traditional means were for getting there.
The
you know, you just had to make it up out of nothing, and you took that to a place where it was, you know, you cared enough so that you. And you applied yourself, you know, to you got there where there was you were making music that was like nothing except what you guys made, because you weren't coming from some you know, traditional, conventional, like background of information about how things are supposed to be done. You were starting from scratch. And and in a lot of ways, that's true of that record.
Yeah.
Of my record.
Well, that Voidoid record, I don't know the Minutemen would ever sounded like they did if we didn't hear that. You know, we're listening to Creedence.
I mean,
we're listening
yeah.
to Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
You know? This thing all of a sudden, like, whoa. There was a couple bands from England, too. This band Wire made little songs. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of an idea for us. But there was something about the Voidoid sound, just every part of it. And no new machine, no synthesizer, no studio technique. It's just the way you dealt with what everybody else was dealing with. But you put very, for us, what sounded like very, very personal stamp.
Do we want to play a Voidoid song? Now that we've sang all this stuff, we probably should do
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. But who are you to tell her who to love? That's up to her. Yes, and the Lord above. You better move on. Well, I know you can buy her fancy clothes and diamond rings, but I believe she's happy with me without those things. Still, you beg me to set her free, but my friend, that will never be. You better move on. I can't blame you for loving her, but can't you understand, man, she's my girl. Go. Now I'm getting mighty mad. You asked me to give up the only love I've ever had. Maybe I would, oh, but I love her so. Never gonna let her go. You better move on. You better move on.
You better move on.
You better move on.
You better move on.
You better move on.
You need a console and shit like a DJ booth. Yeah. Right. A little too tough. Okay, a lot from Pedro show.
Oh yeah, so you play Walking on the Water, right?
That was first.
We were doing that stuff, like, yeah, from the Richard Hell on the Border, which Benson Origin album. Then we heard Arthur Alexander from 1961 doing You Better Move On, which was later, a couple, 3 years later, done by the Rolling Stones in the early part of their career. Then Link Wray, doing Run Chicken Run from 1963. And then Smokey Robinson and the Miracles doing Going to a Go-Go by 1964. Yeah, I noticed for some reason, like, I was just like yesterday quickly trying to prepare for this and grabbing CDs, looking for stuff to play on the show. And then later when I checked out the dates, like, for whatever reason, it's almost all this stuff comes from between 1957 and 1964.
Well, how old were you then?
I don't know. Well, I was like 7 to 14, but to me, what I think the significant thing is that that's when the music was the most interesting.
Ah.
Of course, maybe everybody feels that way about the music that was playing when they were 7, but frankly, I do feel like the Beatles ruined rock and roll, and that's basically what we're learning about.
Yeah.
Like, the music peaked.
Do you know about
right
this Live at Brothers bootleg?
The what brother?
You're playing with the Heartbreakers, and somebody says something, hey, the Beatles ain't that bad, and you say, the Beatles suck.
You're right.
But you got a point, man.
Yeah.
I think...
No, because they just homogenized everything. They turned it into, like, cuteness and pretty harmonies, it took out all the guts.
Yeah, some people say the one good thing they did was make the idea of a band come get popular again, because it was kind of going towards backup guys for a singer.
Uh-huh.
And so they got the idea of a band.
Yeah.
But to me, that's nothing to do with sound. That's more of a logistic. But this idea of garage bands, somehow the Beatles kicked that off.
Well, yeah, just because all of a sudden, everybody was excited by the possibilities of what could be done if you had a band, for sure. Yeah.
We're at the end of the first hour there, right? Yeah. Okay. That's July 27, 2009, first hour. A lot from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour two. July 27, 2009, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show here with Richard Hell and his pad.
Well, we could do a whole half hour, man. We could do the whole...
He's thinking of songs to play here. He's got this Righteous Boot of the Velvet Undergrounds from Cleveland in, what, 68?
66. Yeah, before they did any recording.
Before they had an album out.
And I'm tempted to play the whole side of a half an hour.
Yeah.
But I guess I probably shouldn't do that, right?
You're the guest.
Well, I mean, you could always, like, cut it in half, right?
If you want me to.
I mean, that's easy to do. You can find out. Because I was going to just play the second half of it, the place where it gets really quiet.
I can fade in and fade out, yeah.
So you want? Should we play the whole thing for now?
You want to do it right now?
Decide later whether to use it or not.
You want to do it right now?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Thank you.
Thank you.
From Pedro Show. Let me just hear Richard.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, that was, I can't remember what we might have said before it started, but that was the Velvet Underground in 1966 in Columbus. I can't remember whether I might have said something about Cleveland, because sometimes the concert is described as having been played in Cleveland, but no, it's Columbus, and it's a bootleg live show, and that was a song that gets titled Melody Laughter.
Right.
Melody Laughter.
You showed me what
and
you
I guess
sent.
Like the first 5 or 10 minutes, there's tuning up as much as anything else.
And it was sold by a record store dude in Cincinnati. So we got 3C Ohio towns.
What's
could have been one? Cleveland. Probably was Columbus.
It was Columbus.
It was sold in Cincinnati. And they said the man was killed on a motorcycle. He was going to actually, because it's only the first and last pieces of the gig, he was going to put out the rest later.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, you floated to me there.
Yeah,
and only 300 copies, so it was very sought after. And your copy here has got the cover artist signed it.
Well, it's all over the web now. You know, nothing's rare anymore.
But you got the real dealio there, the physical object. How'd you get it?
That's my wife's.
Ah.
By the way. She showed it to me. So then where were we? What were we talking about?
We're talking about you starting your own band, which, because the other band was collaboration. This is your own band. And I wanted to ask you something that ain't so musical, but it's kind of like the Dolls. What about the clothes? Where'd you get the idea for them clothes coming out of hippie days?
What?
I like those clothes. Those clothes had a big impact on us.
Shoot, man. I mean, I don't know.
Just
like,
came.
That, but okay. I mean, I'm just like, it's just like, it's such old news.
Of course to
man.
You, but not to me. I was in there.
I know, but.
But most, 99% of the people, and that stuff's not even made
about
it.
How many
it
times
enough.
Do I have to tell that story? It's like I must have told
you. You've talked about those clothes.
Times.
Oh.
Like,
really?
Yeah.
Because the dolls were wearing women's clothes. I mean,
it was basically, I basically got it from Raymond Chandler and the Dead End Kids, and with a little bit of like, a little bit of cowboy, and and some more, like gangster.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, you know, it was a way of trying to return to real life, what had become all marketing, you know, and commercial, like representation music as being the realm of people with big expense accounts for boutiques. We were trying to make the clothes be something that was making the point that everybody had the access to it. But I mean, at the same time, we wanted to look sharp. But it's I can't.
What was it like running your own band versus being part of a band? Was it different? You've been playing bass for a while now. Did you have a little more handle on it?
Man, I don't know, man. I don't want to be rude, but I just can't talk about all that stuff all over again. It's like,
okay,
I don't. It's just, I mean, this
I'm just curious.
This is like 30 years ago, and people have been asking me those questions for 30 years.
Yeah, but I'm a guy from a band. You're a guy from a band. I'm looking at it like that.
I know, but that's not the point. The point is me. It's all on the record. You can look it up if you want to. It's like too boring for me to say the same thing that I've said a million times before.
People who talk to you are like rock journalists, and they're not guys from bands.
But they have to do that. It's the same questions.
Well, they are.
That's the point. Yeah. I'm not too original, 1970s all over again. It's like everybody knows that stuff, and if they don't, all they got to do is buy Please Kill Me, buy from the Velvet Soup.
Yeah, but I that. They don't talk about that stuff. That's all.
You're asking
politics.
Me like, why I dressed that way.
Well, the clothes I was curious about. Why
I left television or. How? What does blank generation mean?
I didn't ask you that.
I know, but it's all the same shit.
Ask you that.
It's the same stuff.
I asked you, what's the difference between being part of a band and running your band? And you've been playing bass a while now. I mean, it was a big difference for me from being Minuteman and then going on to make my own band. It was very scary for me.
I don't know, Mike. Still, it's like 30 years ago. Am I putting myself back 30 years to like...
You're the best guy I could ask about it.
What? Why?
Because it'd be going through a new filter, no second hand, no third hand.
Yeah, but
it's just band
it's
stuff.
It's all like
it's
alien.
Just music stuff.
It's like, but it's just
clothes in a way. To me, the early punk, it reminds me of what you said of the Dolls. The clothes had something to do with the music, I thought, because a lot of the guys in the bands were just starting out. So I think it was just as important in some ways. So the clothes were kind of important.
Did you ever
for me as being in a band? Yeah. Because when I
see, I mean,
put on my clothes,
you know what? Right now, I'm writing an autobiography. I've already got almost 300 pages, and after that, I really will just be able to say to people, page 73.
Well, I wanted to get on.
That's basically why I'm writing the book,
okay.
Really, because I can just dispose of all that stuff that's really, to me, is It's such old news that it's like it's
I don't want
like
you to feel uncomfortable. I was going to get to the writing part anyway. But there's some things, if you want to have, hear me out a little bit, I'm curious about. But if it's boring to you and it sounds like I'm not giving you respect, then I just stop.
It's not that much. We'll
get on
respect
to the writing.
It's like, it's just about.
No, maybe don't deserve respect. They're just ridiculous, trite, and this kind
and
of
I'm
shit.
Just lazy, man. And it's like, it gets really tiresome to say something.
Then I'll move on to the stuff you want to talk about.
10,000th time. That's what
now I'll move
you
on.
Know,
well, I can give you a little insight on that, because I've been doing this for 30 years. I've had to answer the same old questions. And, but man, I respect you a lot. And I do it.
You don't get tired of it?
I get tired of taking shits and pisses, too. But, you know, that's one of the prices of challenge.
I think shits and pisses are really pleasant. Because that's something you need to do. You
they
don't fucking need to be, like, repeating the same stuff from previous lifetimes.
I work a music thing, and I have to talk about the old days sometimes, and I don't try to make them feel lame because they didn't hear it the first time.
Well,
okay, I'm sorry. Let's move on to other stuff. Let's move on to your writing. You got tired of music, right? You stopped playing in a band.
Yeah. But like I said, I don't want to offend you. I'm just telling you, I cannot muster the
it's
energy
okay.
to like carry myself back 30 years to something that's just, it would be like, you know,
but you started writing before
like
that
if
you
I
did
asked
the band.
You to tell me the multiplication tables from one, you know, from
okay.
from
I think I get
twos
the
times and the threes times and the fourth times and the five. Let me finish.
Oh.
All right? You understand what I'm saying? Like, if I ask you to tell me the multiplication tables, that's not really hard to do. You could do that, but wouldn't you, like, resist it because it just bores the shit out of you?
No.
No matter whether, you know, how sincerely it was interesting to me, wouldn't you say, come on, you can look that up in a book?
Yeah, I guess.
I'm serious.
My questions are just terrible. But you know, you wrote before you did music, so that's even more old-fashioned than your music.
I didn't
career.
Bring up writing.
No, I am. I'm going to move to writing now, because that's more current. Now, you said, like, in 85, you stopped doing music. Stopped touring.
Yeah, I pretty much, I retired from music, and...
And you don't want to get into why that happened,
because
that's in the book.
What?
You don't want to say why you got out of music.
Yeah, I got out of it because I decided I wasn't suited for it. I hated touring. I was real vulnerable to all the negative sides of it, like taking drugs, because the life is so boring. You have to do something to like pass the time. And I'd also had actually felt in 1977 when I finished the first album and then went on tour in England that I'd achieved everything that I'd gone into music to do, and I was ready to move on, and I was tired of the world of the professional musician. But it just took me those, you know, further 5 or 7 years of staggering on before I was able to finally just call it quits.
Well, you got excited about some stuff, because I know you did a Dim Stars later.
That was like 1 month.
Still?
Yeah, it was like, that whole thing lasted for a month, you know, and that's why I was able to do it, because I knew it was just, you go in, we wrote the songs in 3 weeks, and we recorded them in another 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it. No playing live. And
that's in the early 90s, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was, maybe it was 1990, maybe. I think it was maybe.
So you've been writing again for 5 years.
What do you mean?
Leave music, went to writing.
Oh, yeah, well, actually, you know, for the first few years after I left music,
yeah.
I did not know how I was going to make a living. You know, I was casting around trying to figure it out. Because, you know, getting a reputation... as a writer that's strong enough so that you can actually do it professionally and pay your rent is take some time and effort and initiative, and I didn't know whether that was practical or not. Turned out that it was.
But you always felt you wanted to write anyway, but for adults,
well, I always did write, you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I always wrote. I mean, writing lyrics is writing too, and even when I was writing lyrics, I usually kept notebooks and journals and would write this and that at the same time, though I pretty much kept that under wraps, because when I first started in a band, I really did not want to give anybody the chance to dismiss me by classifying me as like a rock poet or something like that. So I never like acknowledged the writing side.
I got that little book.
Which one? That?
Physically little.
Well, that was much later. That didn't get published until like 1990.
But it's written in those old days.
It was just like notebooks from those days. I was always writing. It's just that's part of my just like built into me.
You came to town to be a poet.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah.
See, that's
but you know, so I mean,
me.
I only made really two albums, not counting the Dim Stars one.
I like Dim Stars.
I like Dim Stars too. Yeah.
But maybe that's why, because you didn't feel the weight, you could get your writing the main thing. So now music can be kind of fun.
Maybe. Well, I didn't say it was fun.
Oh, okay.
I said I liked it okay. Yeah. But I think the album was all, I like the album. It's got a lot of good tunes on it. It has its
Monkey.
Its soft spots too.
Monkey.
But the second record was really painful, though, Destiny Street. Because it happened when I was really in my worst shape of all. It was at the point where I didn't know how to make a new life for myself, but I'd succumbed to all the worst temptations of rock and roll. You know, I was addicted to drugs, and I had no commitment to playing. It was just something that I did to pay the rent. But at the same time, I had my pride, and I wanted everything I did to be the highest possible level I could make it. And I had a lot of things I wanted to convey in songs, but I was just such a mess in that album, and it shows on that record. Because, for one thing, I actually was in such bad shape for a week or 10 days of the recording schedule that day after day, I would not go to the studio because I couldn't bring myself to leave the apartment, and I would just call up and say, put down another guitar part here and go for this when you're doing it, and literally calling it in, though. It was calling in instructions to the guitar players to do this or that, and so the record ended up being this sinkhole of
lameness,
wet.
See, this is not the most inspiring stories for me.
guitars.
But it's the reality.
But it's leading to something.
I know, because you went and got revenge on those bad days by redoing this. Beautiful. Redemption. A little bit. But
so
about
I eventually got the rights to that record back, and just like 5 or 6 years ago. And let it go out of print, thinking I would I would find a way eventually to bring it out somehow improved. Although I didn't have any idea how I could do that, since there were no masters anymore. The guy who produced, recorded the original thing had lost all the tapes. And so all I had was a CD. And what can you do with a CD to make it better? You can't even remaster it because it's already been EQ'd. But then I found this tape of simply the rhythm section playing the parts that actually ended up being the rhythm parts on the original album, which were great. Just bass, drums, and really strictly played interlocking rhythm guitars with no solos, no vocals. And it made me realize that I could use that as the foundation for completely redoing the record and making it sound the way that I would have done in 1982 if I'd had it together.
Oh, 82, wow.
Yeah, it was 1982.
That's right, that's right. So that's kind of far back.
It's pretty far back. But that was the most fun I've ever had in music, was like making this record.
So like...
We call it...
My generation, 77, 80, so it's 5 years.
Yeah. So it's the new record's called Destiny Street Repaired.
Redeemed. Redemption.
And I used Bill Frisell and Mark Rebo and
great musicians.
Ivan Julian from the original band. You know, the record company was really strict, and it was reasonable for them to be about keeping all of that stuff under wraps until it actually gets released, so that, you know, there's at least not like file sharing and free downloading going on before the record's even out there. The people who bring it out is this company called InSound. They're online.
Yeah.
They're like the biggest American distributor of indie vinyl. The major American distributor of indie vinyl, bringing out this new release. But they said it would be cool to play
kind
any cut, right? Not one of the like better known ones, but one that I really think is that I really love. It's less typical because it's Ivan playing, and Mark Rebo does actually the most soloing on this Destiny Street Repaired. But the one I'm going to play.
Ivan's the original guy. Mark Rebo is the new guy. For you guys listening,
Ivan was not on the original record.
Oh, he's not on it. No. Really?
No, he didn't play on Destiny Street.
I didn't know that. See, that's why it's good for me to ask some of these things. I don't know. You know, I don't. That's why I ask them. I didn't know that he's not on that record at all.
No.
Wow.
It's Quine and a guy called Maouche.
So,
we're going to listen to Ignore That Door, the new version of it that's
from Destiny Street Repair.
I didn't even know there was a dude named Maouche.
You never read the back of this album cover, did you, Mike?
Not close, I guess.
You're a music man. You read Ulysses, but you don't read the back of my album
cover. I got holes. Well, I was going to tell you about writers. Like, I can't do it very well. It's a big part of my music. I have big respect for writers. So for you to move from music to writing was not, to me, a slide down. There, here's some music.
However much you're bored, you best ignore that door.
yeah, because actually the, what I have picked out, the music is going to work out pretty well to...
We just heard Ignore That Door from...
From Destiny Street Repair. Yeah, and that's Ivan Julian playing the guitars, the soloing guitars, and he wasn't on the original Destiny Street.
Which why didn't know,
because
he didn't look
close.
The only
person on the original Destiny Street that was in the band that played on Blank Generation was Quine, and me. Yeah, that's one of the... 10 tunes, plus there's a couple of bonus tracks that are songs from those demo sessions that we were talking about earlier, that that version of Time that you played from, and made in 78, 79.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the ones on Destiny Street Repair have never been released. One of them is called Smitten. And the other one is a song that's only come out in this is a live version on an obscure release. But this is a studio version of the song called Fun Hunt. Those two songs are the bonus tracks.
Yeah, that's on... Is that on R.I.P.?
No, that's only on this record called Fun Hunt. There was a bunch of live stuff.
Oh, Fun Hunt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
I can only give you everything. That was a live, like them? Them song you did?
I can only give you everything? Yeah, that's on this. That's on...
That was a great recording, man.
Shoot, man, I'm so tempted to play this one. It's like so much better. It's got...
And that?
Rebo
that one's
plays
pretty
fantastic.
Hot.
Rebo.
Where was that done? Like in Georgia or something? You're on tour, right?
Oh, you mean that live version?
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
No, because it's on Destiny Street.
Yeah, yeah.
The studio version.
But the live one
was
pretty hot, man.
It had something going for it, yeah. But that was like another of the sort of pickup band Voidoids. You know, nobody in that group was on any of the albums. You know?
For you people, this is only Voidoid gig. Well, I got to see.
Yeah, you saw one.
It was Richard at the Whiskey Go Go. And actually, Ivan was in the band.
What year would have that been? You
maybe 82, 83?
Yeah, that was really towards the end, yeah.
And you had a red shirt that buttoned all the way around.
Oh, yeah,
stripping.
Yeah. That's what I was wearing right there.
That's the same shirt. Okay, yeah. The one on the album
on
cover.
The cover.
That was a huge gig for us, because finally, you know, we're talking like 5-6 years after we first hear you, we finally get to see you.
And see, that makes me really ashamed.
Look, it's just a reality. You had it. I know, it's weird. It's a weird, and I don't mean to embarrass you or anything like that, but it's almost foaming like fanboy a little bit. And we could tell there was something up, you know, but, you know, life's a journey, and we thought, well, that's where he is. I didn't know it was so hell.
For so many years there, I was just... You know, I was going through the motions while I, at the same time that everything in me resisted only merely going through the motions. So I was like
full of all this
like confusion and you know, self-criticism. And, it was really complicated and ugly.
Then I got to meet you in 83 in Germany, in Osnabrück, because you actually played with Black Flag and the Minutemen.
Really?
You did.
I know.
You were wearing an overcoat. I shook your hand. You said, hi, Mr. Minuteman. And for me and D. Boone, yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So this is just after us seeing you at this gig. Yeah, you did a Europe tour.
Right. But that wasn't with Ivan, though, right? He wasn't in that group,
no,
was he?
No. This was Osnabrück, Germany. West Germany in those days. I got to even play with you, so I was like, wow.
Oh.
Well, on the same stage that you came here. Yeah, so they're big moments. And then you came into the studio when the Sonics were recording. That was a big deal.
Yeah,
I was so afraid I couldn't
talk.
That's when
I think of it being when I first met you.
Yeah, well, and I was too afraid to talk much.
I know, you were like...
Kay did all the talking.
You seemed like you were like paralyzed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult. So if I say awkward things, it's just hard. Even though, man, we've had some great talks since then about all kinds of stuff. I got you on the radio, and I'm letting the listeners know stuff, and That's just bizarre. I lost my perspective.
But so we gonna close out the hour? I mean,
we got another. We should finish up the hour.
Yeah.
People, check out this Destiny Street Repaired when it comes out. When Richard?
September 1. And it's September 1. You can only get it from InSound. InSound. InSound.com.
Yeah.
Right. That's the thing we put together where it's available in two versions, a Digipak regular 10-cut Destiny Street Repaired that's got these all new tunes, new versions of the song using the original band rhythm tracks, but with these new guitar players, and I sing everything fresh. And the deluxe edition, which is vinyl,
plus
the CD that has the two bonus tracks, and then a big goofy poster that's like double sided. There's actually two posters in one. But yeah, it's really a kick for me to feel like I've been able to recover and that record when it had only been a source of sadness.
I dig.
And now I love it. But anyway.
Well, it's the end of the second hour, right. July 27, 2009. Wow, for Peter Show, hold tight for hour three. We got some Richie Valens coming up. Valens. I would like to learn how to be a writer. That's one reason I do the diaries.
You would like to do what?
And learn how to be a writer. It's July 27, 2009, third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Thank you.
from New York City, and we trucked on down that old fair lane with a heave and a haul. Well, I just couldn't let it go. Get along, treat the little woman, get along. Better be young when you're old, but you get along. Treat the little woman, get along. Better be young when you're old, but you with a heave and a haul. Well, I just couldn't let it go. Well, the train kept on rolling. On that belong, the train kept on rolling. On that belong, the train kept on moving. On that belong, the train kept on rolling. On that belong, with a heave and a hold. Well, I just couldn't let it go.
Got this CD.
Oh yeah, let's pop it out. Well, we started off third hour with a lot of music there.
Richard, oh yeah, yeah. Here. First of all, we had Shostakovich.
Yeah.
From his Preludes and Fugues, and that was the first one, which is a set of 24 that he wrote in 1950 and 51. And these were played by Keith Jarrett. That rendition, and then we heard Bill Evans playing My Foolish Heart live.
Village Vanguard.
In 1961, yeah, at the Village Vanguard. And then Johnny Burnett, Rock and Roll Trio, playing Train Kept a Rollin' from... What year was that? 57, I think.
The year I was born. No bass.
And of course, that song covered a million times since. It was everybody knows best the Yardbirds version. And the band when it had both Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck in it.
Blow Up.
They called it Stroll On.
Stroll
right?
On. It's in that movie, Blow Up.
Blow Up.
But it was actually picture got blown up.
Right.
When I was young, I always thought it was about some kind of bomb. But
the Antonioni, right, about this photographer.
Just like Proud Mary.
I mean, it means it both ways, you know.
Like Proud Mary, I never knew that was about a steamboat.
No.
Yeah. I thought he was being a metaphor about the big wheel keep on turning. It's a fucking paddle wheel. Right. Yeah.
Now I remember when I was like five, and the number one song was... Hound Dog?
Yeah, Elvis.
Yeah. And I can really distinctly remember really well sitting out in the backyard of our little tiny house in the middle of Lexington, Kentucky, playing in the dirt with a radio that I could hear nearby. It was playing Hound Dog.
Whoa!
What the hell is that?
I don't know. Sit on some?
Oh, let's look at the door.
Oh. That was a doorbell.
Who is it? Yes.
Somebody's making scratching sound.
What the hell? Hello? Who the fuck is it?
Sorry, wrong one.
So you're in the backyard. It's not the big
Mama. Yeah, the radio fan. I was completely mystified. Line by line, you ain't nothing but a hound dog just a crying all the time. Like, what does crying have to do with a dog? You ain't never caught a rabbit? Dog, rabbit. I couldn't put it together.
Uh-huh.
And you ain't no friend of mine. It was completely incomprehensible.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to be like a backwoods redneck who grew up with dogs that went hunting for rabbits for you.
Or
you
been
know?
To a dog track because you get the mechanical. Make those
right.
Motherfuckers.
Yeah. But his train kept rolling. It was actually written in, I think it was 51, and played by one of the guys who got credit for writing it, named Tiny Bradshaw. Big band, just pre-rock and roll kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Swing. Like bluesy, boogie, big band sound thing. Yeah, but that Johnny Burnett man that one will live forever for sure.
Yeah, I saw Foghat play it. T Rex.
Oh, no kidding! Yeah. Wow, God, I love T Rex in his early 70s.
It was bizarre.
Yeah, I remember we're those days. Like, that was just when we were starting to really pay a lot of attention, thinking we were going to make a band, and we wanted to know. We wanted to know what was interesting that was out there, and what was interesting to us was in T-Rex, Slade.
Saw Slade too.
Yeah, you saw
10
Slade,
years after, much
right?
better than 10 years
yeah,
after.
Hell yeah. and it was like the sort of hard rock and glam groups were the
we liked them
only
too.
Thing of any interest in it. Like even like a. Roxy Music was kind of cool.
Yeah. They were very cool. Yeah. Not really on the at high school though. A lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Because they were.
Until the girls started liking them, then the guys would kind of. Yeah, maybe that's what it was. It's so weird about, but you know the way we, I gotta say, as boys, we never saw sexual stuff in that. We thought, well, you're in a band, you do shit like that. You call yourself Alice
right.
Cooper.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You wear a flannel, you wear a boa, same shit. That's rock and rollers.
Right.
It was hard for us to understand there was meaning behind any of this shit. We thought that that's just what you do for your band, so, you know, you have your thing.
Well, I think, yeah, that was all. But, I mean, Roxy Music was kind of fey. You know, I mean, like a lot of bands that would be doing stuff like maybe
Little
wearing
Richard.
Makeup or something like that,
yeah, what about
like
Little
Alice Cooper or something like
yeah.
that. It was, you know, it was completely great and beyond accepted because the whole point of having rock and roll bands, half of the point was to offend the
outrage.
Grown-ups,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, right.
So that was fine, but then it did. One of the last frontiers was like actually being like playing up gayness, you know.
Yeah.
Mick Jagger did that.
Little Richard.
Yeah, Little Richard did it
right from the get go.
David Bowie did it, but
yeah.
Little Richard, it's hard to picture him. Being popular, you know, except that the music was so addictive and fantastic and exciting and great. But yeah, man, like the makeup he wore and and
the
how exaggerated he was and like
long
like,
tall
totally
Sally
Queenie.
Yeah, I mean, jeez,
yeah.
These songs are. I mean, the train kept rolling's pretty intense. But
it was like at that time, things were so repressed
right. That
nobody could even interpret it that way, you know?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it would be, like, beyond belief. Nobody...
no way.
Yeah.
But it was, yes, way, and, you know, and later on we figured out, yeah, these guys, you know, it's not just a rock gig.
Right.
Yeah, it's a whole life. Didn't know... Yeah, Roxy was trippy. for us, but we thought they were just kind of original. No, I swear that stuff never came into our minds. I don't know why. Because they all seem so weird, you know. Maybe because our town, very uniform. Not a lot of individuality at that time. The way the hippie stoner thing had come in, had whittled its way down to, a harbor working town. Everyone wore Levi's. So when we started going to those gigs up in Hollywood, man, this was all... it was a mind blow. I remember I spray painted Pedro on my bass, and people thought my name was Pedro. You know, there's the disconnect was so big. So these things that seem a little trivial and small, they were huge things to us. But it helped us be a band and not just copy songs in the bedroom. That's why.
Did you do all your learning just by ear, like?
Copying the record.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's what I mean.
There was a hippie guy who lived in his car who showed us how to copy off records, and we were 14.
So were you able to like? Tune up by ear right away? Did you get that?
That took a while. We thought if you played down on the corner and it sounded right, then you were in tune. But we didn't know your down on the corner had to be like the other guy's down on the corner.
Well, you had to match up.
Yeah, we thought
instrument to instrument.
Yeah, we thought some guys like the strings loose, some like them tight. I have no tapes of these days. Thank God.
That's great.
You know, no sensitivity. No, we didn't know.
That's perfect.
Fucking didn't know. And then trying to learn off the records, you know, you couldn't slow them down. You couldn't repeat them. I remember, you know, just doing the American Woman riff for hours on end. But his mom, it was the projects. This is after Navy Housing. And there's no guns a lot yet, but there's a lot of fighting. So she wants us in the house after school. Yeah. So she wants us in a band. Nothing like to do gigs. Just wants us jamming after school in the house.
Once you started doing it, and she saw... I mean, she didn't actually suggest it from the beginning. But it wasn't her idea. Was it?
Oh, yeah. She's going to be in a band. You're going to play bass. Why? I didn't even know fucking what a bass was.
Really?
Yeah, you got to understand.
Where did she get the idea?
She played guitar.
Oh.
So she wanted her son to play guitar. Yeah. And then the bands, you could tell it on the album covers, there was a bass in every band.
So did you guys like immediately get excited by it once you started? I mean, did you get completely, you know, engaged with the...
Missing parts. We didn't know music was for expression, so we never wrote our own songs.
Yeah.
You just
but it was still them. was it like a thrill though?
Oh, yeah, but like building models, like wow, almost like the real thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's that riff. It kind of savant, like not savant. That means you're smart. I mean, but kind of.
What do you think?
It would capture us just doing the one lick over and over.
Do you think that the stuff that you learn to play by practicing, or then because you were imitating records, the little, the riffs and the song construction and et cetera. Do you think that ended up having a big influence on what your songs sounded like later?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what intrigued us about Voidoids: the licks, the chords. Even though we didn't have instruction on it, by hearing all that other music. This stuff was fucking mind blow to us.
Try to imitate some of the Voidoid songs?
Too hard.
Yeah.
That shit was so square. You know? And that's why when we first hear jazz from these punk guys, and we thought they were doing punk too. We had no idea. All we knew was arena rock. When the punk thing comes and you see these bands, well, first time we ever saw clubs. And, you know, you could talk to people, and you could talk to the guys who just played. Then we thought, wow, we can do this.
Right.
But before that, never thought, no way.
How long had you been messing around before you got inspired by a punk
band? Punk comes in 76 when we graduated, 18. Started at 13, so five years.
Wow. So were you working pretty hard in those 5 years? Like,
It was in the dark. The one guy taught us how to copy, you know, where you try to match the note with one of the notes on that riff and then build around it. So we were, you know, it was stumble bum shit.
You know what I remember from first starting playing, the earliest times that a few of us got together, bass, guitar, drums, maybe two guitars, but for me it started out with just the three of us, was this unbelievable feeling of transporting power. I hate using that word power because power is usually negative. But it was just this sense at the very beginning, before you had any habits of playing, that you could go anywhere with this, and just playing like one note followed by a second note, and then repeating that one note followed by the second note, and repeating that again, it just filled you with ideas, and it felt like so powerful. Like from those one note back and forth, you could see in your mind's eye this whole array of possibilities, like just blooming out of it, and the words you could say to it, and how you could play it quieter the next time you played it, and what could be the import of the lyrics that you make up, and how you can do it in a way that nobody had ever done it before, and how you can do it in a way that would be exciting in this area or exciting in that area. And then when a drummer comes in and slaps something, and then the other instrument adds something in between what you're playing, and it just it comes alive, and it's something that you've made out of nothing. And you can take it anywhere you want, and make it into something that's unlike anything that had ever been done before, but that tells a story or conveys a picture that you desire to make real out in
build it.
It
was just 5 years late for us.
So fucking
see, it came to you right away. We didn't have the culture. We didn't have that culture.
Yeah.
We didn't know. It took us 5 years to find that.
How much time do we have left?
17, 14, 31, 29 minutes.
Oh, we got that much? Okay.
Yeah, you know,
I want to make sure we
believe in that came to us. Right. That came to us. When we saw those gigs. And you know what? What do the other guys say? These guys are late and they can't play. They missed the whole... because of that culture. At first, Stephen D. Boone. But the first thing I said was, we can do this, man. And then he got into it. Because you got to understand, sometimes it's hard. That's why I consider you one of the pioneers, in our lives especially. You opened up all this possibility where we... best we're going to do is copy something. We can't use this as... possibility maker.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Well,
nobody to tell us. Nobody.
Yeah, and you know, I was a lot older than you were. You know, like I said, I started my first band at 22, and I'd already been writing as being something that I took seriously. For, you know, since I was 17, it was my real identity to myself was as a writer. So I was completely. I lived within this self-concept of, of me making works, you know. And doing it in music was just... the thing about it, doing it in music was it was so physical.
We did feel that right away. There was something about, you know...
Not only was it physical, but it was emotional in a way that writing was not, because there's something about music, and this has always like blown my mind and fascinated me from the first time I put my finger on it, that there's something about music that is inherently emotional. Like, it's just like, for example, and this isn't like some theory. It's actual. It's scientifically true. And for instance, an obvious way of example of it is minor chords.
Yeah.
Sad. You play something minor and it sounds sad. And all that is sound.
Yeah.
And everybody knows this. I mean, there's no controversy about it.
Yeah.
Minor equals sad.
Yeah.
Right? And the whole range of emotions can be translated or conveyed or built into the music. Music is inherently emotional. Juxtaposing one tone with another, and how you do it rhythmically, and the combinations of notes and chords, and all the elements that go to making music. It's a language of emotions. Somehow. It's really mysterious. It seems so strange that could be. It doesn't. You know what I'm saying? Why should sound equal emotions? I mean,
resonance. Somehow the nervous system gets caught up in resonance.
No, resonance, but the thing is, it happens, and it's like, so you feel yourself doing that when you're making music. You're actually,
resonating is actually you're shaking things up, right? So your body is being shaken.
I mean, it's sound is air that's been made to vibrate. Right, you know, right. I mean, that's all that's happening. But it's physical, right? But the way that certain sounds have an emotional import is really odd. I mean, I don't know.
What about this connect? The brain, the mind. Maybe the same thing. Emotion, the music. One's a physical. One is set of idea or feeling.
Well,
there's been discussion about this, the brain, the mind.
Yeah.
Somehow they're connected. How?
Well, one is physical and one is the process of abstract thinking.
Idea.
Right,
idea.
Yeah.
But also culture, and the other creatures it's living with. You're schooled in certain things. And maybe bathing in sound, you learn certain things that ain't mine, but it's still a connect, physical to emotional. I don't think emotional is always an idea. Huh. Right? Maybe? Yeah, right.
But anyway, it was a new thing apart from writing. Like writing, it's not like you put this word next to that word and it has an emotional import. But in music, you put this note next to that note, and it actually has an effect on the way you feel.
What about this? This never happened to you, but almost every book I read, it could be written 800 years ago. I start seeing parts of my life in the story.
Uh-huh.
There's something loose enough about literature where you can see, like, whoa, this guy knows what's going on. And there's obviously no connection. It was written way before.
Well, but I mean, it's intended to be talking about human experience, so it makes sense for
even
you to
future,
be able to identify with it.
It's still going to relate.
Yeah.
It's like, man, this guy wrote this thing just for me, and you know he couldn't have.
Yeah.
He wasn't near you. He's time-wise, location-wise, culture-wise, but there's something trippy about literature that way that's kind of special in its own self, that might not be so intellectual, you know, because experiences are kind of emotional things. You remember things wrong, right? I have.
Yeah, sure.
Why does that happen? If memory was accurate, because you want to change them, you don't, you fuck up and make mistakes.
I think there's a lot of reasons why.
Yeah, right.
Mix up their memories.
The literature kind of taps in on those peculiar things that aren't so. What I'm trying to get at is maybe writing isn't all so rational.
No, I'm not.
And some people, like surreal people, try to exploit the non-rational.
Definitely,
right?
Sure. But that's Sure, there's plenty of parts of literature that don't have to do with strictly rational, intellectual thought, but still, there's no equivalent to a minor chord in literature. You can't say put these five words next to those these class of five words like a verb, a conjunction, and whatever next to this class of five words like a noun, and all of a sudden you're going to be sad. No, yeah. that's all I'm saying. Yeah. The music has all these powers that when you first start feeling the possibilities of using them and you know it's hard to maintain that. The problem is you start playing, you write some songs, some songs work better than others, you get into habits you find that this song is really effective somehow, and you end up tending to kind of repeat doing things that way and
writing the same song.
It's hard. It's really hard to keep that initial thrill at the infinity of possibilities. You start falling into habits.
Track houses.
And that's what conventions are. You know,
right, the garage goes on this side, the porch on that side.
Right, right. And
terrible.
So it's especially hard in rock and roll because you're out touring all the time, and you've got to be, playing a. Everybody falls into playing the same set every night because it's so much easier to do it that way. And I mean, every once in a while there's an exception, somebody that demands more of themselves, but it's almost always like that. And pretty soon, and everything is done by rote. The thing that you hear them saying that seems so amusing and spontaneous, they said the night before.
They're gonna say tomorrow.
And it just starts all becoming oppressive. Yeah.
We were talking about double nickels on the dime. This was a problem. 45 pieces of music. Oh, we got to keep them from all sounding the same. And what we did was we used a lot of outside words. I started writing music to other words. I kept writing the same fucking riff over and over.
Right.
Because they were to my words. So D-Boom would just have stuff written, not even to be songs. And I would start getting Georgie. You know, and Jack Brewer's cousin, we were using the landlady's. A landlady left a note about the tub leaking. But it was just to get out of. That was a way for me to get out of the music trap of track housing.
Right.
Was the other. Because everybody's got different rhythm in their words.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's
you know great. What I mean?
Yeah.
There's liberating things about both the. And confinement things about both disciplines.
Yeah, well, I wasn't comparing it to saying it was any different.
I know, but in my mind, I always am.
The thing is, when you got to go out and be playing every night, night after night after night, and that is like, that definitely does.
I have never written songs on tour. Never.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
People do that, but yeah.
I can't. So much focus has to be on that gig and working that. I can't do it. What I usually do is, here comes time for a record. And it's almost like you're in school and cramming for the goddamn. So many things seem like school. You got to get in front of the class. You got to read your report. You got to cram for the test. It's shit you thought was going to be all gone.
Right.
I
thought
this
was
one phase of my life.
Set an alarm clock, man. There's nothing, and I'm about touring. More typical than alarm clocks. just play some more music.
Yeah.
Thank you. already said goodbye. And since you gotta go,
so we just heard Beethoven's.
We started off, right.
The first of those three cuts we just heard was Beethoven's Sonata number 28 in A major, Opus 101, the first movement. The whole thing is like 22 minutes long. We just heard the first movement. Then we heard Bessie Banks. Oh, yeah. Well, the pianist was Anton Querty playing that Beethoven. And then we heard Bessie Banks doing Go Now.
Which you
from
used?
1964. That song, I supplied the title to my first novel called Go Now.
When did you write that?
93 to 95.
And that's the first novel.
Published in 96.
You got a lot of little books you gave me. Remember when I got out of that sickness and you were doing that reading in Beyond Baroque?
Uh-huh.
You gave me a bunch of books.
Well, I was out there behind a book that had just been published. What year was that?
That was 2000.
I guess that was Hot June. And Cold. It was about Hot and Cold had just been published.
I came in the...
I know, you'd been in the hospital, right?
You
drove up there.
Maybe we turned down that fucking... that technician.
Right. And
I almost died. You were the first time I got out of the house in 6-7 months.
All right. I know.
And it was, Richard Bonney, my plumber friend in Pedro, told me, Richard Hale's in town. I said, I'm getting out.
That was so
I was
hip.
Still opened up down there.
Right.
I said, I'm going.
That was so hip to see you there. That was great. That was great. And the third cut.
But those books, were those poem books mainly?
What books?
That you gave me that night.
I don't remember.
Okay, you gave me books, like Hot Cold was one.
Not Cold was...
Not Cold, I mean, and maybe Voidoid. You had a different version, not this new one you gave me.
There was the first... the first time that was printed was like in the 90s. I could have had that with me.
You did. You gave them to me, signed on them.
Right.
It was great for me. It was a real spirit lifter after that hell ride. I went and that's my second opus source material. What's that hell ride? And I used Dante, Divine Comedy. Remember the first time I was in this play? We talked about Dante.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I haven't read that. That's on my list. But I've read La Vida Nuova, which is
a
book that is one of my favorite books ever.
Yeah, trippy.
But the third cut was Richie Valens doing Come On, Let's Go, which still, sounds so real and fresh, right? Cause it's right in front of you. This is a weird set of music that I grabbed, most of it is pretty familiar. None of it is really obscure. Probably the least known thing is that Velvets.
Well, for sure that is.
Right, it's a wide range of types of music, and every thing that I played is something that I really, really love, though, it could have been any of another, 200 cuts that I have here, but I was curious to see if I just, grabbed them without... consideration of the genre or anything.
Good.
What it would sound like to juxtapose them. They're played basically in random order. I didn't really I just wondered what it would come out sounded like playing this weird range, jazz and classical and rock and roll and
that's universal
boys and girls
music.
How that worked, though. I did, like I say, I noticed that the big majority of it came from like this 1 6 or 7 year period, like just at the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s. We'll see when we listen to it back. It's weird because some of them, I'm sure it's going to be hard to adjust because they're so different to go from one cut to the next.
Yeah.
But I find because we listen to some of them as we're going along, though most of them we don't hear much of the music because we're just like ripping it down to the computer. But it's hard to adjust, but then as you listen, you get pulled into the the style of whatever it is you're listening to, since the music is so good, even though it might be much quieter than what you just heard or something.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
think it might not just hold up or something, yeah. but no, you get.
They all have their own worlds.
Yeah. You can get pulled into it.
Which is the personal statement I think music can bring and still be big enough to get on.
Yeah.
Get on this boat. And I want to thank you for being on this boat, this Walk from Pedro show boat, being patient with me, tolerant of my stupid questions.
I'm sorry, I get. You thought I was giving you a hard time, but I didn't mean to be giving you a hard time. I'm just like, you know, I had to be honest because when I'm, you know, when I try to deal with certain questions, there's no way that I can handle it. I just have to say sorry. You have to try another one.
Yeah. Because and there's some old stuff. In fact, Destiny Street Repaired is the old thing coming back, and it's valid.
Yeah.
And it addresses questions that haven't been beaten into the ground.
Right.
So, it's been the July 27th, 2009 Watt from Pedro show. Keep your powder dry. Thank you.